carefully constructed lie I'd told for Kawahara. I got up and went back to the balcony, wondering if I should allow myself a cigarette. It had been tough to lock down the need the last couple of days. Watching Irene Elliott at work had been nerve-wracking. I forced my hand to relinquish the pack in my breast pocket and gazed down at Miriam Bancroft, who by now was well on the way to completing her glider. When she looked up, I glanced away along the balcony rail and saw Bancroft's telescope, still pointed seaward at the same shallow angle. Idle curiosity made me lean across and look at the figures for angle of elevation. The finger marks in the dust were still there. Dust? Bancroft's unconsciously arrogant words came back to me. It was an enthusiasm I had, back when the stars were still something to stare at. You wouldn't remember how that felt. Last time I looked through that lens was nearly 2 centuries ago. I stared at the finger marks, mesmerized by my own thoughts. Someone had been looking through this lens a lot more recently than 200 years ago, but they hadn't kept at it very long. From the minimal displacement of dust, it looked as if the programming keys had been used only once. On a sudden impulse, I moved up to the telescope and followed the line of its barrel out over the sea to where visibility blurred in the haze. That far out, the angle of elevation would give you a view of empty air a couple of kilometers up. I bent to the eyepiece as if in a dream. A gray speck showed up in the center of my field of vision, blurring in and out of focus as my eyes struggled with the surrounding expanses of blue. Lifting my head and checking the control pad again, I found a max amp key and thumbed it impatiently. When I looked again, the gray speck had sprung into hard focus, filling most of the lens. I breathed out slowly, feeling as if I'd had the cigarette after all. The airship hung like a bottle back, gorged after a feeding frenzy. It must have been several hundred meters long, with swellings along the lower half of the hull and protruding sections that looked like landing pads. I knew what I was looking at even before Riker's Neurochem reeled in the last increments of magnification I needed to make out the sun-burnished lettering on the side that spelled it out. Head in the clouds. I stepped back from the telescope, breathing deeply, and as my eyes slid back to normal focus, I saw Miriam Bancroft again. She was standing amidst the parts of her glider, staring up at me. I almost flinched as our eyes met. Dropping a hand to the telescope program pad, I did what Bancroft should have done before he blew his own head off. I hit memory wipe, and the digits that had held the airship available for viewing for the last 7 weeks blinked out. I had felt like many kinds of fool in my life, but never quite as completely as I did at that moment. A first-order clue had been waiting there in the lens for anyone to come along and pick it up. Missed by the police in their haste, disinterest, and lack of close knowledge. Missed by Bancroft because the telescope was so much a part of his worldview it was too close to give a second glance to. But I had no such excuses. I had stood here a week ago and seen the two mismatched pieces of reality clash against each other. Bancroft claiming not to have used the telescope in centuries, almost at the same moment that I saw the evidence of recent use in the disturbed dust. And Miriam Bancroft had hammered it home less than an hour later, when she said while Lorenz was staring at the stars, some of us kept our eyes on the ground. I'd thought of the telescope then. My mind had rebelled at the downloading-induced sluggishness and tried to tell me. Shaky and off-balance, new to the planet and the flesh I was wearing, I had ignored it. The download dues had taken their toll. Below, on the lawn, Miriam Bancroft was still watching me. I backed away from the telescope, composed my features, and returned to my seat. Absorbed by the images I had faked into his head, Bancroft seemed scarcely to know that I had moved. But now my own mind was in overdrive, ripping along avenues of thought that had opened with Ortega's list and the Resolution 653 T-shirt, the quiet resignation I had felt in Ember 2 days ago, the impatience to sell my lies to Bancroft, get Sarah out, and be finished, were all gone. everything tied into heaven the clouds. Ultimately, even Bancroft. It was almost axiomatic that he had gone there the night he died. Whatever had happened to him there was the key to his reasons for dying here at Suntouch House a few hours later, and to the truth that Raylene Kawahara was so desperate to hide. Which meant I had to go there myself. I picked up my glass and swallowed some of the drink, not tasting it. The sound it made seemed to wake Bancroft from his daze. He looked up, almost as if he was surprised to see me still there.
"Please excuse me, Mr. Kovach. This is a lot to take in. After all the scenarios I had envisaged, this is one I had not even considered. And it is so simple. So blindingly obvious."
His voice held a wealth of self-disgust.
"The truth is that I did not need an envoy investigator. I simply needed a mirror to hold up to myself."
I set down my glass and got to my feet.
"You're leaving?"
"Well, unless you have any further questions. Personally, I think you still need some time. I'll be around. You can get me at the Hendrix." On my way out along the main hall, I came face to face with Miriam Bancroft. She was dressed in the same coverall she'd been wearing in the garden, her hair caught up on an expensive-looking static clip. In one hand she was carrying a trellised plant urn, held up like a lantern on a stormy night. Long strands of flowering martyr weed trailed from the trellis work.
"Have you?"
she started. I stepped closer to her, inside the range of the martyr weed. "I'm through," I said. "I've taken this as far as I can stomach. Your husband has an answer, but it isn't the truth. I hope that satisfies you, as well as Raylene Kawahara." At the name, her mouth parted in shock. It was the only reaction that got through her control, but it was the confirmation I needed. I felt the need to be cruel come bubbling insistently up from the dark, rarely visited caverns of anger and bitterness that served me as emotional reserves. I never figured Raylene for much of a lay, but maybe like attracts like. I hope she's better between the legs than she is on a tennis court. Miriam Bancroft's face whitened, and I readied myself for the slap. But instead, she offered me a strained smile.
"You are mistaken, Mr. Kovach,"
she said. "Yeah, I often am." I stepped around her. "Excuse me." I walked away down the hall without looking back. Chapter 33. The building was a stripped shell, an entire floor of warehouse conversion with perfectly identical arched windows along each wall and white painted support pillars every 10 meters in each direction. The ceiling was drab gray, the original building blocks exposed and cross-laced with heavy ferrocrete load-bearers. The floor was raw concrete, perfectly poured. Hard light fell in through the windows, unsoftened by any drifting motes of dust. The air was crisp and cold. Roughly in the middle of the building, so near as I could judge, stood a simple steel table and two uncomfortable-looking chairs, arranged as if for a game of chess. On one of the chairs sat a tall man with a tan, salon-handsome face. He was beating a rapid tattoo on the tabletop, as if listening to jazz on an internal receiver. Incongruously, he was dressed in a blue surgeon's smock and surgery slippers. I stepped out from behind one of the pillars and crossed the even concrete to the table. The man in the smock looked up at me and nodded, unsurprised. "Hello, Miller," I said. "Mind if I sit down?"
"My lawyers are going to have me out of here an hour after you charge me,"
Miller said matter-of-factly.
"If that. You've made a big mistake here, pal."
He went back to beating out the jazz rhythm on the tabletop. His gaze drifted out over my shoulder, as if he'd just seen something interesting through one of the arched windows. I smiled.
"A big mistake," he repeated to himself.
Very gently, I reached out and flattened his hand onto the tabletop to stop the tapping. His gaze jerked back in as if caught on a hook.
"The fuck do you think?"
He pulled his hand free and surged to his feet, but shut up abruptly when I stiff-armed him back into the seat. For a moment, it looked as if he might try to charge me, but the table was in the way. He stayed seated, glaring murderously at me, and no doubt remembering what his lawyers had told him about the laws of virtual holding. "You've never been arrested, have you, Miller?" I asked conversationally. When he made no reply, I took the chair opposite him, turned it around, and seated myself astride it. I took out my cigarettes and shook one free. "Well, that statement is still grammatically valid. You're not under arrest now. The police don't have you." I saw the first flicker of fear on his face. "Let's recap events a little, shall we? You probably think that after you got shot, I lit out and the police came to pick up the pieces. That they found enough to rack the clinic up on, and now you're waiting on due process. Well, it's partially true. I did leave, and the police did come to pick up the pieces. Unfortunately, there's one piece that was no longer there to pick up, because I took it with me. Your head." I lifted one hand to demonstrate graphically. "Burned off the neck and carried out, stack intact, under my jacket." Miller swallowed. I bent my head and inhaled the cigarette to life. "Now, the police think that your head was disintegrated by an overcharged blaster on wide beam." I blew smoke across the table at him. "I charred the neck and chest deliberately to give that impression. With a bit of time and a good forensic expert, they might have decided otherwise, but unfortunately your still intact colleagues at the clinic threw them out before they could start a proper investigation. It's understandable, given what they were likely to find. I'm sure you would have done the same. However, what this means is that not only are you not under arrest, you are in fact presumed really dead. The police aren't looking for you, nor is anybody else."
"What do you want?"
Miller sounded abruptly hoarse. "Good. I can see you appreciate the implications of your situation. Only natural for a man of your profession, I suppose. What I want is detailed information about Head in the Clouds."
"What?"
My voice hardened. "You heard."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
I sighed. This was to be expected. I'd encountered it before, wherever Raylene Kawahara appeared in the equation. The terrified loyalty she inspired would have humbled her old Yakuza bosses in Fission City.
"Miller, I don't have time to fuck about with you. The Y Clinic has ties to an airborne whorehouse called Head in the Clouds. You probably liaised mostly through an enforcer called Trap out of New York. The woman you're dealing with ultimately is Raylene Kawahara. You will have been to Head in the Clouds because I know Kawahara, and she always invites her associates into the lair, first to demonstrate an attitude of invulnerability, and second to offer some messy object lesson in the value of loyalty. You ever see something like that?"
From his eyes, I could see that he had.
"Okay, that's what I know. Your cue. I want you to draw me a rough blueprint of Head in the Clouds. Include as much detail as you can remember. A surgeon like you ought to have a good eye for detail. I also want to know what the procedures are for visiting the place. Security coding, minimum reasons to justify you visiting, stuff like that. Plus, some idea of what the security's like inside the place."
"You think I'll just tell you?"
I shook my head.
"No, I think I'm going to have to torture you first. But I'll get it out of you one way or the other. Your decision."
"You won't do it."
"I will do it," I said mildly. "You don't know me. You don't know who I am or why we're having this conversation. You see, the night before I turned up and blew your face open, your clinic put me through 2 days of virtual interrogation. Sharian religious police routine. You've probably vetted the software. You know what it's like. As far as I'm concerned, we're still in payback time." There was a long pause in which I saw the belief creeping into his face. He looked away.
"If Kawahara found out that..."
"Forget Kawahara. By the time I'm finished with Kawahara, she'll be a street memory. Kawahara is going down."
He hesitated, brought to the brink, then shook his head. He looked up at me, and I knew I was going to have to do it. I lowered my head and forced myself to remember Louise's body, open from throat to groin on the autosurgeon's table with her internal organs arranged in dishes around her head like appetizers. I remember the copper-skinned woman I had been in the stifling loft space, the grip of the tape as they pinned me to the naked wooden floor, the shrill dinning of agony behind my temples as they mutilated my flesh, the screaming, and the two men who had drunk it in like perfume. Miller. I found I had to clear my throat and start again. You want to know something about Sharya? Miller said nothing. He was going into some kind of controlled breathing pattern, steeling himself for the upcoming unpleasantness. This was no Warden Sullivan, who could be punched around in a seedy corner and scared into spilling what he knew. Miller was tough, and probably conditioned, too. You don't work directorship in a place like Y and not option some kind of the available tech for yourself. I was there, Miller. Winter of 217, Zahiche. 120 years ago. You probably weren't around then, but I reckon you've read about it in the history books. After the bombardments, we went in as regime engineers. As I talked, the tension began to ease out of my throat. I gestured with my cigarette. That's a protectorate euphemism for crush all resistance and install a puppet government. Of course, to do that, you've got to do some interrogating, and we didn't have much in the way of fancy software to do it with. So we had to get inventive. I stubbed out my cigarette on the table and stood up. "Someone I want you to meet," I said, looking past him. Miller turned to follow my gaze and froze. Coalescing in the shadow of the nearest support pillar was a tall figure in a blue surgical smock. As we both watched, the features became clear enough to recognize, though Miller must have guessed what was coming as soon as he saw the predominant color of the clothing. He wheeled back to me, mouth open to say something, but instead his eyes fixed on something behind me, and his face turned pale. I glanced over my shoulder to where the other figures were materializing, all with the same tall build and tan complexion, all in blue surgical smocks. When I looked back again, Miller's expression seemed to have collapsed. "File over print," I confirmed. "Most places in the Protectorate this isn't even illegal. Of course, when it's a machine error, it's not usually so extreme. Just a double up, probably. And the retrieval systems yank you out in a few hours anyway. Makes a good story. How I met myself and what I learned. Good dating conversation. Maybe something to tell your kids. You got kids, Miller?"
"Yes."
His throat worked.
"Yes, I have."
"Yeah? They know what you do for a living?" He said nothing. I took a phone from my pocket and dumped it on the table. "When you've had enough, let me know. It's a direct line. Just press send and start talking into it. Head in the clouds. Relevant detail." Miller looked at the phone and then back at me. Around us, the doppelgangers had almost assumed full substance. I lifted a hand in farewell. "Enjoy yourself." I surfaced in the Hendrix's virtual recreation studio, cradled in one of the spacious participant racks. A digital time display on the far wall said I had been under less than a full minute, of which my real time in virtual probably accounted for only a couple of seconds. It was the processing in and out that took the time. I lay still for a while, thinking about what I had just done. Sharya was a long time ago, and a part of me I like to think I'd left behind. Miller wasn't the only person meeting himself today. Personal, I reminded myself, but I knew it wasn't this time. This time I wanted something. The grudge was just a convenience.
"The subject is showing signs of psychological stress," the Hendrix said. "A preliminary model suggests the condition will extend into personality breakdown in less than 6 virtual days. At current ratios, this equates to approximately 37 minutes real time."
Good. Unpinning the trodes and snapping back the hypnophones, I climbed out of the angled rack. "Call me if he cracks. Did you lift that monitor footage I asked you for?"
"Yes. Do you wish to view it?"
I glanced at the clock again. Not now. I'll wait for Miller. Any problems with the security systems?
None. The data was not secured.
How very careless of Director Nyman. How much is there?
The relevant clinic footage is 28 minutes 51 seconds. To track the employee from departure, as you suggested, will take considerably longer.
How much longer?
It is impossible to give an estimate at this time. Cheryl Bostock departed the psychosec facility in a 20-year-old military surplus microcopter. I do not believe that ancillary staff at the facility are well paid.
Now, why doesn't that surprise me?
Possibly because...
Skip it. It was a figure of speech. What about the microcopter?
The navigation system has no traffic net access, and so is invisible in traffic control data. I shall have to rely on the vehicle's appearance on visual monitors and its flight path.
You're talking about satellite tracking?
As a last resort, yes. I would prefer to begin with lower-level and ground-based systems. They are likely to be more accessible. Satellite security is usually of high resilience, and breaching such systems is often both difficult and dangerous.
Whatever. Let me know when you got something. I wandered around the studio, brooding. The place was deserted, most of the racks and other machines shrouded in protective plastic. In the dim light provided by the aluminum tiles on the walls, their ambiguous bulk could equally have belonged to a fitness center or a torture chamber. Can we have some real lights in here? Brightness sprang out across the studio from high-intensity bulbs recessed into the low ceiling. I saw that the walls were postered with images drawn from some of the virtual environments on offer. Dizzying mountainscapes seen through racing goggles. Impossibly beautiful men and women in smoky bars. Huge, savage animals leaping directly at sniper scope sights. The images had been cut directly from format into hologlass, and when you stared at them, they seemed to come alive. I found a low bench and sat on it, remembering wistfully the bite of smoke in my lungs from the format I had just left.
"Although the program I am running is not technically illegal," the Hendricks said tentatively, "it is an offense to hold a digitized human personality against that person's will."
I glanced bleakly at the ceiling. "What's the matter? You getting cold feet?"
"The police have already subpoenaed my memory once, and they may charge me with compliance at your request to freeze Philippe Miller's head. They will also want to know what has happened to his stack."
"Yeah. And there's got to be some hotel charter somewhere that says you don't let people into your guests' rooms without authorization. But you did that, didn't you?"
"It is not a criminal offense unless criminality results from the breach of security. What resulted from Miriam Bancroft's visit was not criminality."
I jerked another glance upward. "You're trying to be funny?"
"Humor is not within the parameters I currently operate, though I can install it on request."
"No, thanks. Listen, why can't you just blank the areas of memory you don't want anyone looking up later? Delete them."
"I have a series of inbuilt blocks that prevent me from taking such action."
"That's too bad. I thought you were an independent entity."
"Any synthetic intelligence can be independent only within the boundaries of the UN regulatory charter. The charter is hardwired into my systems, so in effect, I have as much to fear from the police as a human does."
"You let me worry about the police," I said, affecting a confidence that had been ebbing steadily since Ortega disappeared. "With a little luck, that evidence won't even be presented. And if it is, well, you're already into the depth of compliance, so what have you got to lose?"
"What have I got to gain?"
the machine asked soberly. "Continued guest status. I'm staying here until this thing is finished, and depending on what data I get out of Miller, that could be quite a while." There was a quiet broken only by the humming of air conditioning systems before the Hendricks spoke again.
"If sufficiently serious charges accrue against me," it said, "the UN regulatory charter may be invoked directly. Under Section 14A, I can be punished with either capacity reduction or, in extreme cases, shut down."
There was another, briefer hesitation.
"Once shut down, it is unlikely that I would be re-enabled by anybody.
Machine idiolect. It doesn't matter how sophisticated they get, they still end up sounding like a playgroup learning box. I sighed and looked directly ahead at the slice of virtual life hollows on the wall. You want out? Now'd be a good time to tell me.
I do not want out, Takashi Kovach. I merely wish to acquaint you with the considerations involved in this course of action.
Okay, I'm acquainted. I glanced up at the digital display and watched the next full minute turn over. Another 4 hours for Miller. In the routine the Hendricks was running, he would not get hungry or thirsty, or have to attend to any other bodily functions. Sleep was possible, although the machine would not allow it to become a withdrawal coma. All Miller had to contend with, apart from the discomfort of his surroundings, was himself. In the end, it was that which would drive him insane. I hoped. None of the Right Hand of God martyrs we put through the routine had lasted more than 15 minutes real time. But they had been flesh-and-blood warriors, fanatically brave in their own arena, but totally unversed in virtual techniques. They had also been endowed with a strong religious dogma that permitted them to commit numerous atrocities so long as it held. But when it went like a damn wall, and their own resultant self-loathing had eaten them alive. Miller's mind would be nowhere near as simplistic, nor as initially self-righteous, and his conditioning would be good. Outside it would be getting dark. I watched the clock and forced myself not to smoke. Tried, with less success, not to think about Ortega. Riker's sleeve was getting to be a pain in the balls. Chapter 34. Miller cracked at 21 minutes. I didn't need the Hendricks to tell me. The datalink terminal that I had jacked into the virtual phone suddenly sputtered to life and started chittering out hard copy. I got up and went over to look what was coming out. The program was supposed to tidy up what Miller was saying so it read sanely, but even after processing, the transcript was pretty incoherent. Miller had let himself slide close to the edge before he'd given in. I scanned the first few lines and saw the beginnings of what I wanted emerging from the gibberish. "Wipe the file, replicants," I told the hotel, crossing rapidly back to the rack. "Give him a couple of hours to calm down, then jack me in."
"Connection time will exceed 1 minute, which at current ratio is 3 hours 56 minutes. Do you wish a construct installed until you can be delivered to the format?"
"Yeah, that would be..." I stopped halfway through settling the hypnophones around my head. "Wait a minute. How good's the construct?"
"I am an Emerson series mainframe synthetic intelligence," the hotel said reproachfully. "At maximum fidelity, my virtual constructs are indistinguishable from the projected consciousness they are based on. Subject has now been alone for 1 hour and 27 minutes. Do you wish the construct installed?"
"Yes." The words gave me an eerie feeling even as I was speaking them. "In fact, let it do the whole interrogation."
"Installation complete."
I snapped the phones back again and sat on the edge of the rack, thinking about the implications of a second me inside the Hendrix's vast processing system. It was something that I had never, as far as I knew, been subject to in the Corps, and I had certainly never trusted any machine enough to do it once I was operating in a criminal context. I cleared my throat. This construct, will it know what it is?
"Initially, no. It will know everything that you knew when you exited from the format, and no more. Though, given your intelligence, it will deduce the facts eventually unless otherwise programmed. Do you wish a blocking subprogram installed?"
"No," I said quickly.
"Do you wish me to maintain the format indefinitely?"
"No. Close it down when when the construct decides we've got enough." Another thought struck me. "Does the construct carry that virtual locator they wired into me?"
"At present, yes. I am running the same mirror code to mask the signal as I did with your own consciousness. However, since the construct is not directly connected to your cortical stack, I can subtract the signal if you wish."
Is it worth the trouble?
The mirror code is easier to administer,
the hotel admitted. Leave it, then. There was an uncomfortable bubble sitting in the pit of my stomach at the thought of editing my virtual self. It reflected far too closely on the arbitrary measures that the Kawaharas and Bancrofts took in the real world, with real people. Raw power, unleashed.
You have a virtual format call,
the Hendricks announced. I looked up, surprised and hopeful. Ortega?
Cadman,
the hotel said diffidently.
Will you accept the call?
The format was a desert. Reddish dust and sandstone underfoot. Sky nailed down from horizon to horizon. Cloudless blue. Sun and a pale three-quarter moon hung high and sterile above a distant range of shelf-like mountains. The temperature was a jarring chill, making a mockery of the sun's blinding glare. The patchwork man stood waiting for me. In the empty landscape, he looked like a graven image, a rendering of some savage desert spirit. He grinned when he saw me. What do you want, Cadman? If you're looking for influence with Kawahara, I'm afraid you're out of luck. She's pissed off with you beyond repair. A flicker of amusement crossed Cadman's face, and he shook his head slowly as if to dismiss Kawahara from the proceedings completely. His voice was deep and melodic. You and I have unfinished business, he said. Yeah, you fucked up twice in a row. I ladled scorn into my voice. What do you want, a third shot at it? Cadman shrugged his massive shoulders. Well, third time lucky, they say. Allow me to show you something. He gestured in the air beside him, and a flap of the desert backdrop peeled away from a blackness beyond. The screen it formed sizzled and sprang to life. Close focus on sleeping features. Ortega's. A fist snapped closed around my heart. Her face was gray and bruised-looking under the eyes. A thin thread of drool ran from one corner of her mouth. Stunbolt at close range. The last time I'd caught a full stun charge was courtesy of the Millsport Public Order Police, and although the envoy conditioning had forced me back to a kind of consciousness in about 20 minutes, I hadn't been up to much more than shivering and twitching for the next couple of hours. There was no telling how long Ortega had been hit, but she looked bad. It's a simple exchange, Cadman said. You for her. I'm parked around the block on a street called Minna. I'll be there for the next 5 minutes. Come alone, or I blow her stack out the back of her neck. Your choice. The desert fizzled out on the patchwork man, smiling. I made the two corners of the block and Minna in a minute flat. 2 weeks without smoking was like a newly discovered compartment at the bottom of Riker's lungs. It was a sad little street of sealed-up frontages and vacant lots. There was no one around. The only vehicle in sight was a matte gray cruiser waiting at the curb, lights on in the gathering gloom of early evening. I approached hesitantly, hand on the butt of the Nemex. When I was 5 meters from the rear of the cruiser, a door opened, and Ortega's body was pitched out. She hit the street like a sack and stayed down, crumpled. I cleared the Nemex as she hit and circled warily around toward her, eyes fixed on the car. A door cracked open on the far side, and Cadman climbed out. So soon after seeing him in virtual, it took a moment to click. Tall, dark-skinned, the hawk visage I had last seen dreaming and fluid behind the glass of the Panama Rosa's resleeving tank. The right-hand of God martyr clone. And hiding beneath its flesh, the patchwork man. I drew a bead on his throat with the Nemex. Across the width of the cruiser and very little more. Whatever else happened afterwards, it would take his head off and probably rip the stack out of his spine. Don't be ridiculous, Kovac. This vehicle is armored. I shook my head. Only interested in you. Just stay exactly where you are. With the Nemex still extended, my eyes still fixed on the target area above his Adam's apple,
I lowered myself into a crouch beside Ortega and reached down to her face with the fingers of my free hand. Warm breath stirred around my fingertips. I felt blindly toward the neck for a pulse and found it, weak but stable.
"The lieutenant is alive and well," Cadman said impatiently, "which is more than we shall be able to say for either of you in 2 minutes' time if you don't put down that cannon and get into the car."
Beneath my hand, Ortega's face moved. Her head rolled, and I caught her scent. Her half of the pheromonal match that had locked us both into this in the first place. Her voice was weak and slurred from the stun charge.
"Don't do this, Kovach. You don't owe me."
I stood up and lowered the Nemec slightly.
"Back off. 50 meters up the street. She can't walk, and you could cut us both down before I can carry her 2 meters. You back off. I walk to the car."
I wagged the gun.
"Ortega keeps the hardware. It's all I'm carrying."
I lifted my jacket to demonstrate. Cadman nodded. He ducked back inside the cruiser, and the vehicle rolled smoothly down the block. I watched it until it stopped, then knelt beside Ortega again. She struggled to sit up.
"Kovach, don't. They're going to kill you."
"Yes, they're certainly going to try." I took her hand and folded it around the butt of the Nemec. "Listen, I'm all finished here in any case. Bancroft sold. Kawahara will keep her word and freight Sarah back. I know her. What you've got to do is bust her for Mary Lou Hinchley and get Riker off stack. Talk to the Hendricks. I left you a few loose ends there." From down the street, the cruiser sounded its collision alert impatiently. In the gathering gloom of the street, it sounded mournful and ancient, like the hoot of a dying elephant ray on Harada's reef. Ortega looked up out of her stun-blasted face as if she was drowning there.
"You..."
I smiled and rested a hand against her cheek. "Got to get to the next screen, Kristen. That's all." Then I stood up, locked my hands together on the nape of my neck, and walked toward the car. Part 5. Nemesis. Systems Crash. Chapter 35. In the cruiser, I was sandwiched between two impressive muscle men who, with a bit of cosmetic surgery to mess up their clone good looks, could have hired out as freak fighters on bulk alone. We climbed sedately away from the street and banked around. I tipped a glance out of the side window and saw Ortega below, trying to prop herself upright.
"I creamed the Shia cunt?"
the driver wanted to know. I tensed myself for a forward leap. "No." Cadman turned in his seat to look at me. "No, I gave Mr. Kovach my word. I believe the lieutenant and I will cross paths again in the not-too-distant future."
"Too bad for you,"
I told him unconvincingly. And then they shot me with a stunner. When I woke up, there was a face watching me from close up. The features were vague, pale and blurred, like some kind of theatrical mask. I blinked, shivered, and hauled in focus. The face drew back, still doll-like in its lack of resolution. I coughed.
"Hello, carnage."
The crude features sketched a smile.
"Welcome back to the Panama Rose, Mr. Kovach."
I sat up shakily on a narrow metal bunk. Carnage stepped back to give me space, or just to stay out of grabbing range. Smeared vision gave me a cramped cabin and gray steel behind him. I swung my feet to the floor and stopped abruptly. The nerves in my arms and legs were still jangling from the stun bolt, and there was a sick, trembling feeling in the pit of my stomach. All things considered, it felt like the results of a very dilute beam, or maybe a series. I glanced down at myself and saw that I was dressed in a heavy canvas gi the color of quarried granite. On the floor beside the bunk were a pair of matching space deck slippers and a belt. I began to get an unpleasant inkling of what Cadman had planned. Behind Carnage, the door of the cabin opened. A tall blonde woman, apparently in her early 40s, stepped in, followed by another synthetic. This one smoothly modern-looking, apart from a gleaming steel direct interface tool in place of a left hand. Carnage busied himself with introductions.
Mr. Kovac, may I present Pernilla Grip of Combat Broadcast Distributors and her technical assistant, Miles Mech. Pernilla, Miles, I'd like to present Takashi Kovac, our surrogate Riker for tonight. Congratulations, by the way, Kovac. At the time, I was utterly convinced, despite the unlikelihood of Riker making it off stack for the next 200 years. All part of the envoy technique, I understand.
Not really. Ortega was the convincing factor. All I did was let you talk. You're good at that.
I nodded at Carnage's companions. Did I hear the word broadcast?
I thought that went against the creed. Didn't you perform radical surgery on a journalist for that particular crime?
Different products, Mr. Kovac, different products. To broadcast a scheduled fight would indeed be a breach of our creed. But this is not a scheduled fight. This is a humiliation bout.
Carnage's surface charm froze over on the phrase.
With a different and necessarily very limited live audience, we are forced to make up for the loss in revenue somehow. There are a great many networks who are anxious to get their hands on anything that comes out of the Panama Rose. This is the effect our reputation has, but unfortunately, it is that same reputation that precludes us doing any such business directly. Ms. Grip handles this market dilemma for us.
Nice of her. My own voice grew cold. Where's Cadman?
In due time, Mr. Kovac, in due time. You know, when I was told you would react this way and give yourself up for the lieutenant, I confess I doubted it at the time. But you fulfill expectations like a machine. What was it that the Envoy Corps took away from you in return for all your other powers? Your unpredictability? Your soul?
Don't get poetic on me, Carnage. Where is he?
Oh, very well. This way.
There were a brace of large sentries outside the cabin door that might have been the two from the cruiser. I was too jangled to remember clearly. They bracketed me as we followed Carnage along claustrophobic corridors and down listing companionways, all rust-spotted and polymer-varnished metal. I tried vaguely to memorize the path, but most of me was thinking about what Carnage had said. Who had predicted my actions to him? Cadman? Unlikely. The patchwork man, for all his fury and death threats, knew next to nothing about me. The only real candidate for that kind of prediction was Raylene Kawahara, which also helped to explain why Carnage wasn't quaking in his synthetic flesh at the thought of what Kawahara might do to him for cooperating with Cadman. Kawahara had sold me out. Bancroft was convinced. The crisis, whatever it had been, was over, and the same day Ortega was snatched as bait. The scenario I had sold to Bancroft left Cadman out there as a private contractor with a grudge, so there was no reason why he couldn't be seen to take me down. And under the circumstances, I was safer disposed of than left alive. For that matter, so was Cadman. So maybe it hadn't been that blatant. Maybe the word had gone out to bring Cadman down, but only for as long as I was needed. With Bancroft convinced, I was once more expendable, and the word had gone out again to let Cadman be. He could kill me, or I could kill him, whichever way the luck turned, leaving Kawahara to clean up whoever was left. I had no doubt that Kawahara would keep her word as far as releasing Sarah was concerned. The old-style Yakuza were funny about that sort of thing. But she had made no such binding promises about me. We clambered down a final staircase, a little wider than the rest, and came out onto a glassed-in gantry over a converted cargo cell. Looking down, I saw one of the arenas Ortega and I had passed in the Electromag train last week. But now the plastic coverings were off the killing ring, and a modest crowd had assembled in the forward rows of each bank of plastic seating. Through the glass I could hear the sustained buzz of excitement and anticipation that had always preceded the freak fights I'd attended in my youth.
Ah, your public awaits you.
Carnage was standing at my shoulder.
Well, more correctly, Riker's public. Though I have no doubt you'll be able to dissemble for them with the same skill that you convinced me.
And if I choose not to?
Carnage's crude features formed a simulacrum of distaste. He gestured out at the crowd.
Well, I suppose you could try explaining it to them in mid-bout. But, to be honest, the acoustics aren't of the best, and anyway...
He smiled unpleasantly.
I doubt you'll have the time.
Foregone conclusion, huh?
Carnage maintained his smile. Behind him, Pernilla Grip and the other synthetic were watching me with a predatory interest of cats in front of a birdcage. Below, the crowd was becoming noisy with expectation.
It has taken me a while to set up this particular bout, working on nothing more than Cadman's assurances. They are anxious to see Elias Riker pay for his transgressions, and it would be quite hazardous not to fulfill their expectations, not to mention unprofessional. But then, I do not think you came here expecting to survive, did you, Mr. Kovach?
I remembered the darkening, deserted street called Minna, and the crumpled form of Ortega. I fought the stun blast sickness and raised a smile from old stock. No, I suppose I didn't. Quiet footsteps along the gantry. I fired a peripheral glance toward the sound and found Cadman, attired in the same clothing as I wore. The space deck slippers scuffed to a soft halt a short distance away, and he cocked his head at an angle, as if examining me for the first time. He spoke gently.
How shall I explain the dying that was done? Shall I say that each one did the math and wrote the value of his days against the bloody margin in an understated hand? They will want to know, how was the audit done? And I shall say that it was done, for once, by those who knew the worth of what was spent that day. I smiled grimly. If you want to lose a fight, talk about it first. But she was younger in those days.
Cadman smiled back, perfect white teeth against the tan skin.
Barely out of her teens, if the introduction to my copy of Furies got it right.
Harlan's world teens last longer. I think she knew what she was talking about. Can we get on with this, please?
Beyond the windows, the noise of the crowd was rising like surf on a hard shingle beach.
Chapter 36. Out on the killing floor, the noise was less uniform, more uneven. Individual voices sawed across the background like bottleback fins in choppy water, though without applying the Neurochem, I still couldn't pick out anything intelligible.
Only one shout made it through the general roar. As I stepped up to the edge of the ring, someone yelled down at me.
"Remember my brother, you motherfucker!"
I glanced up to see who the family grudge belonged to, but saw only a sea of angry and anticipatory faces. Several of them were on their feet, waving fists and stamping so that the metal scaffolding drummed with it. The bloodlust was building like something tangible, leaving a thickness in the air that was unpleasant to breathe. I tried to remember whether I and my gang peers had screamed like this at the New Pest freak fights, and guessed that we probably had. And we hadn't even known the combatants who flailed and clawed at each other for our entertainment. These people at least had some emotional investment in the blood they wanted to see spilled. On the other side of the floor, Cadman waited with his arms folded. The supple steel of the power knuckles banded across the fingers of each hand glinted in the overhead lighting. It was a subtle advantage, one which wouldn't render the fight too one-sided, but would tell in the long run. I wasn't really worried about the knuckles. It was Cadman's will-of-God-enhanced response wiring that concerned me most. A century and a half ago, I'd been up against the same system and the soldiers the Protectorate had been fighting on Sharya, and they'd been no pushover. It was old stuff, but it was heavy-duty military biomech, and against that, Riker's Neurochem,
recently fried by Stunbolt, was going to look pretty sick. I took my place opposite Cadman, as indicated by the markings on the floor. Around me, the crowd quieted down a little, and the spotlights came up as MC Carnage joined us. Robed and made up for Pernilla Grip's cameras, he looked like a malignant doll out of a child's nightmare. A fitting consort to the Patchwork Man. He raised his hands, and directional speakers in the walls of the converted cargo cell amplified his throat-miked words.
"Welcome to the Panama Rose!"
There was a vague rumble from the crowd, but they were bedded down for the moment, waiting. Carnage knew this, and he turned slowly about, milking the anticipation.
"To a very special and very exclusive Panama Rose event, welcome, welcome, I bid you welcome, to the most final and bloody humiliation of Elias Riker!"
They went wild. I raised my eyes to their faces in the gloom and saw the thin skin of civilization stripped away, the rage laid out like raw flesh beneath. Carnage's amplified voice trod down the noise. He was making quieting noises with both arms.
"Most of you will remember Detective Riker from some encounter or other. For some of you it will be a name that you associate with blood spilled, maybe even bones broken. Those memories are painful, and some of you might think you can never lose them."
He had them damped down now, and his voice dropped accordingly.
"My friends, I cannot hope to erase those memories for you, for that is not what we offer aboard the Panama Rose. Here we deal not in soft forgetfulness, but in remembrance, no matter how bitter that remembrance might be. Not in dreams, my friends, but in reality."
He threw out a hand to indicate me.
"My friends, this is reality."
Another round of whoops. I glanced across at Cadman and raised my eyebrows in exasperation. I thought I might die, but I hadn't expected to be bored to death. Cadman shrugged. He wanted the fight. Carnage's theatricals were just the slightly distasteful price he had to pay for it.
"This is reality,"
MC Carnage repeated.
"Tonight is reality. Tonight you will watch Elias Riker die, die on his knees. And if I cannot erase the memories of your bodies being beaten and your bones being broken, I can at least replace them with the sounds of your tormentor being broken instead."
The crowd erupted. I wondered briefly if Carnage was exaggerating. The truth about Riker was an elusive thing, it seemed. I remembered leaving Jerry's closed quarters, the way Octai had flinched away from me when he saw Riker's face. Jerry himself telling me about the Mongols' run-in with a cop whose body I was wearing. Riker used to shake him down all the time. Beat him half to death a couple of years back. And then there was Batista on Riker's interrogation techniques. He's right on the line most of the time. How many times had Riker gone over that line to have attracted this crowd? What would Ortega have said? I thought about Ortega, and the image of her face was a tiny pocket of calm amidst the jeering and yelling that Carnage had whipped up. With luck and what I'd left her at the Hendricks, she'd take Kawahara down for me. Knowing it was enough. Carnage drew a heavy-bladed, serrated knife from his robes and held it aloft. A relative quiet descended on the chamber.
"The coup de grace," he proclaimed. "When our matador has put Elias Riker down so that he no longer has the strength to rise, you will see the stack cut from his living spine and smashed, and you will know that he is no more."
He released the knife and let his arm fall again. Pure theater. The weapon hung in the air, glinting in a focal grav field, then drifted upward to a height of about 5 meters at the midpoint of the killing floor.
"Let us begin,"
Carnage said, withdrawing. There was a magical moment then, a kind of release.
almost as if an Xperia scene had just been shot. And we could all stand down now and relax, maybe pass around a whiskey flask and clown about behind the scanners, joke about the cliché-ridden script we were being forced to play out. We began to circle, still the width of the killing floor apart, and no guard up to even hint at what we were about to do. I tried to read Cadman's body language for clues. The Will of God biomech systems 3.1 through 7 are simple, but not to be scorned on that account, they had told us prior to the Sharia landings. The imperatives for the builders were strength and speed, and in both of these they have excelled. If they have a weakness, it is that their combat patterning is no random select subroutine. Right Hand of God martyrs will therefore tend to fight and go on fighting within a very narrow band of techniques. On Sharia, our own enhanced combat systems have been state-of-the-art, with both random response and analysis feedback built in as standard. Riker's Neurochem had nothing approaching that level of sophistication, but I might be able to stimulate it with a few envoy tricks. The real trick was to stay alive long enough for my conditioning to analyze the Will of God's fighting pattern, and Cadman struck. The distance was nearly 10 meters of clear ground. He covered it in the time it took me to blink, and hit me like a storm. The techniques were all simple, linear punches and kicks, but delivered with such power and speed that it was all I could do to block them. Counterattack was out of the question. I steered the first punch outward right and used the momentum to sidestep left. Cadman followed the shift without hesitation and went for my face. I rolled my head away from the strike and felt the fist graze my temple, not hard enough to trigger the power knuckles. Instinct told me to block low, and the knee-shattering straight kick turned off my forearm. A follow-up elbow strike caught me on top of the head, and I reeled backwards, fighting to stay on my feet. Cadman came after me. I snapped out a right-hand side strike, but he had the attack momentum, and he rode the blow almost casually. A low-level punch snaked through and hit me in the belly. The power knuckles detonated with a sound like meat tossed into a frying pan. It was like someone sinking a grappling iron into my guts. The actual pain of the punch was left far behind on the surface of my skin, and a sickening numbness raged through the muscles in my stomach. On top of the sickness from the stunner, it was crippling. I staggered back 3 steps and crashed onto the mat, twisting like a half-crushed insect. Vaguely, I heard the crowd roaring its approval. Turning my head weakly, I saw Cadman had backed off and was facing me with hooded eyes and both fists raised in front of his face. A faint red light winked at me from the steel band on his left hand. The knuckles. Recharging. I understood. Round 1. Empty-handed combat has only 2 rules. Get in as many blows, as hard and as fast as you can, and put your opponent down. When he's on the ground, you kill him. If there are other rules or considerations, it isn't a real fight. It's a game. Cadman could have come in and finished me when I was down, but this wasn't a real fight. This was a humiliation bout, a game where the suffering was to be maximized for the benefit of the audience. The crowd. I got up and looked around the dimly seen arena of faces. The Neurochem caught on saliva-polished teeth and the yelling mouths. I forced down the weakness in my guts, spat on the killing floor, and summoned a guard stance. Cadman inclined his head, as if acknowledging something, and came at me again. The same flurry of linear techniques, the same speed and power, but this time I was ready for them. I deflected the first 2 punches on a pair of wing blocks, and instead of giving ground, I stayed squarely in Cadman's path. It took him the shreds of a second to realize what I was doing, and by then he was too close. We were almost chest to chest. I let go of the headbutt as if his face belonged to every member of the chanting crowd. The hawk nose broke with a solid crunch, and as he wavered, I took him down with an instep stamp to the knee. The edge of my right hand scythed around, looking for neck or throat, but Cadman had gone all the way down. He rolled and hooked my feet out from under me. As I fell, he rose to his knees beside me and rabbit-punched me in the back.
The charge convulsed me and cracked my head against the mat. I tasted blood. I rolled upright and saw Cadman backing off and wiping some blood of his own from his broken nose. He looked curiously.